Mix tuned to yesterday, broadcasting shows from the golden age of radio. Welcome, I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, crime. Later on, we hear The Whistler with the story All Damage Covered. But right now, it's suspense. From January 13th, 1957, on CBS, we hear Helmut Dantin in Russian New Year.
Suspense.
These last hours of my life, I wonder, how will I be remembered? I think of what Engels said when Karl Marx died. With his death, mankind is shorter by a head. I wonder what will be said of me. It is through his books that Marx is remembered, while I've been a man of action, not of words. So will I be forgotten? Or worse still, will I be remembered only in the writings of bourgeois journalists who already have distorted my motives and minimized my importance in the revolutionary movement? Especially in regard to the action I undertook in St. Basil's Cathedral on the eve of the New Year. It is only Olga Karolska they write about, vastly exaggerating the role she played. Olga Karolska. Why, she was a political ignoramus, a victim of every bourgeois superstition. She was nothing, a zero, a puppet controlled by me. Olga believed that she was in love with me. I encouraged her in that illusion. She might prove valuable to me since she worked as a servant in the household of Prince Ogareff. On Sundays, when she was allowed a few hours for herself, she invariably came to spend the time with me in my room near the university.
Boris. Boris, it's nearly dark.
Oh, you're leaving? Make sure the door is latched. There is a draft up those stairs.
Is that all you have to say? No goodbye, nothing. You're like a stone.
I would prefer steel.
Sometimes I think I should stop coming here to see you.
Perhaps you should.
Boris, if I didn't come, what would you do?
Well, I would read the newspapers from Geneva a day earlier.
What if it was because I loved someone else?
You think I would be jealous?
You take me for granted. Just as Prince Ogareff took his wife for granted.
Now, have they quarreled again? Has she locked him out of the room again?
Worse, she's left him this time.
I thought she was only spending a few days at court.
Oh, it'll be more than a few days. She's madly in love with the Tsar, and he with her. On Wednesday, she sent for her clothes and jewels, and sent a letter to Prince Ogareff. If only you could have seen his face when he read it.
His valuable property stolen by the Tsar. Oh, what a dilemma. He can't even complain to the police.
No, Boris. He loves his wife.
Just as he loves his horses and his serfs. And...
Oh, you wouldn't say that if you saw how he looked. Or if you heard him calling on God to bring her back to him, threatening to kill the Tsar.
When did he do that?
He was pacing up and down, muttering to himself. I overheard him. He really meant it. I'm sure of that.
What makes you think so?
Well, yesterday when I was just in his study, he said some strange things to me. He talked about the Tsar's father, about how he'd been assassinated. He said he thought the terrorists who killed him were very brave men. I didn't answer, though he seemed to expect me to. I was afraid he'd heard that my uncle was one of the terrorists.
Of course, he was trying to make contact with our organization through you. Why didn't you speak up?
I was afraid. Besides, what good would it do?
That's not up to you. Now listen. This week, the first moment you are alone with the prince, tell him about your uncle and tell him you know someone he might like to meet.
Who?
A nihilist and a member of the executive committee, me.
No, Boris. It could be dangerous for you.
Possibly, but without danger, the game grows cold. You understand? I want you to bring him here.
No, I won't.
Oh, what were you saying a few moments ago, Olga? That you should stop coming here to see me?
You know I didn't mean it.
Maybe you did. Because you aren't going to come here anymore, Olga, unless you bring Prince Ogareff with you next Sunday. During the week, I began to devise a plan. A simple, daring plan which would mean glory for me and an end of tyranny in Russia. On Sunday, I waited impatiently. It was mid-afternoon before they arrived.
Boris, This is Prince Ogata.
How do you do?
How do you do?
Come in, Excellency. Olga, I think the prince would prefer to talk to me privately.
Yes, I suppose so.
May I come back a little later, Boris?
If you like. Come in, Excellency.
Thank you. Olga said that you wanted to meet me.
And to meet you, Prince Ogareff, a man has only to express the wish to one of your servants. Come now, you are here because you wanted to meet me.
I assure you, I've never heard your name until...
There is no need to waste time. You are here because you and I desire the same end.
End?
We both want to kill Lazar.
Oh, no, no.
You don't want to kill Lazar? Then we have nothing to talk about.
Oh, no. I do want to kill him.
Excellent. Maybe we can join forces. But first, I would like to understand you better. For instance, why do you want to kill Lazar?
For the same reason as you. For Russia. For the Russian people. To free them from his tyranny.
Ah, yes. And you have great love for the Russian people.
Of course.
And you have thought about this? You have a plan?
No, not really. You see, I thought that you...
I maybe have more experience.
Yes.
That's true enough. But still, you must have considered where and when, if not how, and by whom.
I only know it won't be easy. He's always heavily guarded.
Yes, our beloved Tsar, our little father, who fears his people so much, he never lets them see him.
Because of what happened to his father, he has a terror of assassination.
And well, he should. Now, since you have come here without a plan, let me tell you mine. A plan to kill not only the Tsar, but his entire court. The cream of the aristocracy with one blow.
How?
In St. Basil's Cathedral, on the eve of the new year.
Oh, no.
The cathedral is cleared for the midnight mass. No common people are allowed inside, only members of the court. I am told that the Tsar waits until the last moment and then enters the cathedral secretly through a private passage.
I tell you, it's not possible.
With 60 pounds of melanite strategically placed at 3 central pillars, we can bring down the cathedral dome. Not a soul will escape. But you don't seem to approve.
I hadn't thought of killing so many.
A few hundred aristocrats? Do they matter? Think of what you will be doing for the millions of Russian people whom you say you love.
You think I don't?
I doubt if you can, since you are not one of them. But actually, that's not important. Revolutions aren't born out of love, but out of hate.
And you think I don't hate?
Perhaps you do. I am told that your wife is an exceptionally beautiful woman.
Then you knew
why. So that's your revolution, Prince Ogareff? Set off by jealousy?
Haven't you ever lost someone you love?
I have never loved and never will. Because I know that to love is to surrender. To hate is to continue the battle. Well, now, do we understand each other?
Yes. Yes, we do.
Then sit down. We have many things to discuss. It was then 2 weeks before the eve of the new year. Prince Ogareff and I met several times again to complete our plans in my room, on the street, in the library of the university.
Then I'll have to get the melanite?
Yes, they won't question an aristocrat.
But if they should ask me?
Say you need it for work on your estate in the country, to blast out stumps or to widen the channel of the stream television. Ah, the explosive cap. I won't need you for anything else, Prince Ogareff, until the final night.
And then?
You and I will meet once more for the last time. Besides the prince, I needed 2 other confederates, a man and a woman. Naturally, I had already decided on Olga Karolska. And the following Sunday, I told her my plan.
No, no, Boris.
You aren't willing to take the risk?
Willing or not, you know, I do whatever you say. But I beg you, not the cathedral.
It won't be nearly as dangerous as you think.
I wouldn't care if it were the opera house or the palace, but if we destroy the cathedral...
You're afraid of the wrath of God? Well, I'll take full responsibility and you will be absolved of all guilt.
No, I'm afraid for you. For your soul, not mine.
My soul? What is a soul? Olga Karolska, you come from a revolutionary family, yet you allow yourself to be drugged by this opiate of religion?
We don't know for sure. If there is a God...
If there is, my soul will be damned. But after this life in Russia, hell can't be any worse. Now I needed to find the right man. Someone passive like Olga. Someone in awe of me. A man who preferred to follow rather than to lead. A man such as Sergius Lem. Sergius was colorless and pliable, like a blob of wax, ready to be molded into any shape. He worked at the university as a tutor, and like all scholars in our enlightened society, he was ragged and half-starved. I looked him up, bought him a meal, and then while he was still warm with gratitude, I unfolded my plan.
And I am to pretend I'm a merchant from Riga?
Yes, now listen carefully. Well, I tell you again, step by step, I will bring you the clothes, not too elegant, not too shabby, and some second-hand suitcases. Then you will go to the house just opposite the cathedral and rent the apartment.
The front apartment facing the square?
Yes, yes. You will say that you have just come from Riga on business.
And that my wife will join me in a few days.
Yes, yes. Olga will be there in a week from today. The following night, I will come with the final instructions. When I went to the apartment Sergius had rented, it was 3 days before the new year. Olga and Sergius were waiting with all the equipment. The tubes of melanite, the wire, the metal hook, the grill, the explosive caps, the electric key. Olga, playing the part of the merchant's wife, was wearing a new dress and cloak.
Do I look all right, Boris?
Take off those flowers. No real lady would wear them.
Oh. Now?
Yes, you'll do. Now listen carefully. The cathedral is nearly empty tonight. In a few minutes, Mass will begin. Olga, you will take the wire. Wind it under your cloak, around your waist. Sergius, you and I, we will take each 10 tubes of melanite. Both of you will go directly to the chapel at the right of the main altar. Mm-hmm. There is a curtained alcove where you can hide.
What about you?
I will have to come back here for the rest of the explosives. Then I will join you in the alcove. When everyone is left, we will make our preparations. It will take us about an hour.
And then we come back here?
No. The cathedral will be locked up. We will have to stay there until morning. Olga, why are you shivering? Are you cold?
I didn't know we'd have to stay there all night.
Does it matter? I intend to sleep. But if you like, you can spend the night praying for our success. No one paid any attention to us as we crossed the snow-covered square. There was no wind, and the air was filled with a raw, freezing mist. I think there's going to be another storm.
Yes, it'll be snowing by morning.
Just as I hoped.
They've begun the mass.
Yes, now remember, go directly to the chapel and pay no attention to me.
What?
Quickly, go in quickly. Olga, don't stand there staring.
It's black.
Go on.
Yes, I'm going. Oh, Boris, cross yourself. I beg you, cross yourself.
Fool, go on in.
Dear Heavenly Father, have mercy on us. For what we mean to do, have mercy on him. Have mercy on him.
Unnoticed into the darkened chapel to the right of the main altar, while I went the opposite way to an icon on the east wall. There I hid the drill and the tubes of melanite in a recess behind the icon, then knelt for a few moments, pretending to pray. I laughed to myself, thinking how Olga had prayed to God for mercy. If God did exist, he would show us no mercy, for we were Russians, and all of Russia is under a curse.
Thank you.
came back to the cathedral with the rest of the Melanites, I too went to the chapel. Olga and Sergius were in the alcove behind the altar where the priest prepared the Eucharist, and I crowded in beside them.
How much longer?
Don't you hear?
I can't tell. I haven't gone to church for years.
I haven't since my mother died.
Shh. It's nearly over. People left by ones and twos, then the priests and the acolytes. Finally, we were alone in the vast cathedral, lit only by flickering candles on the altar and under the icons.
Boris, I'm afraid...
Be quiet. We'll put 10 of the tubes under the seat next to that front pillar. That's where the Tsar will sit. Then 10 more opposite, and the last 10 near that pillar in the middle.
Is that what the hooks are for? To fasten the tubes under the seat?
That's right. That's your job. Huh? Olga, start unwinding the wire. Sergius, fasten the hooks.
Yeah.
I will connect the explosive caps. When the melanite was all in place, with the explosive caps connected, we ran a wire under a row of seats, fastening it so that it could not be seen. At the end of the seat, a tapestry covered the wall. We ran the wire behind the tapestry up to a small window. Then I lifted Sergius up to push the window open.
It won't open all the way.
That's enough. Do you have the wire?
Yes.
Good. Do you see that drain pipe outside?
Yes.
Can you reach it with the auger?
I think so, yes.
Drill a hole in the pipe. Then feed the wire into it enough to reach the ground. When our work was done, we went back to the alcove and sat huddled together on the floor. After a time, I slept. I had no dreams. Everything worked in our favor. In the morning, when we left the cathedral, it was snowing hard. We stayed in the apartment all day. That night, I watched from the window until the square was almost deserted. Then I went out, alone, to finish our work. Snow was still falling heavily. The soft, silent curtain of whiteness that blotted out my footprints and hid me from any passerby. I went to the drain pipe, reached up, and found the wire and pulled it out. I fastened the end to another coil of wire, which I unrolled across the square, methodically stamping it down into the snow. I then brought the end of the coil through the window of the apartment.
Is it done?
It's done. Tomorrow, just after midnight, Russia will be in our hands.
Until then?
You and Olga stay here. I'll be back tomorrow evening after a final meeting with Prince Ogareff. Come in, Prince Ogareff. Well?
The Tsar will attend the midnight mass with his ministers and the court.
You're quite sure?
Quite sure. Just now, when I came through the square, they were already putting up the ropes to keep back the crowd.
Yes, they will jam the square just to stare at a building where they know the Tsar is kneeling to pray. Well, we're going to show them how his prayers are going to be answered.
Yes.
What's wrong with you?
This is filthy work.
Revolutions aren't made with rose water?
No, I suppose not. At least my wife has gone to spend the new year at our estate in the country.
Good. Then you won't be distracted from the last thing you have to do. Now, we'll have no way of knowing when the Tsar enters the cathedral, since he won't face the crowd in the square. So Sergius Lem will wait outside, below the steps. When the Tsar arrives and the mass has begun, come out and tell Sergius. He will bring the word to me. At 11 that night, searchers left the apartment and made his way to the rope barrier below the cathedral steps. Olga and I waited together in the apartment. There was only one light, a single kerosene lamp standing near the gleaming electric key. Olga walked up and down, her shadow leaping on the wall. I stood at the window, looking out. They are lighting the bonfires.
Bonfires?
All around the square. I saw them piling up the wood this afternoon. What a crowd. They can scarcely get the sleighs through.
Boris, are you sure there's no other way?
To do what?
To free the people.
If I knew of another way, I would still choose this one.
I was afraid you'd say that. The thought of power has already changed you. In destroying this tyrant, you will become one yourself.
I am not a czar. I'm the son of a peasant, one of the people.
Not after tonight. If you do this, it will set you apart from everyone.
Olga, if you're trying to say you want to leave...
No, I'll stay, as long as you need me.
Look at them milling like cattle. Yes, cattle.
Boris, do you love me? You have never said it.
What?
I keep thinking, if I knew there was love between you and me, I wouldn't mind so much.
Women always talking about love.
Then you can't say it.
Do I have to? Don't you know? Listen, the mass has started. But where is Prince Ogareff?
Maybe the Tsar isn't there yet.
They wouldn't have started without him.
He may have decided not to come.
Ah, there. There is the prince now, coming down the steps. The fool. Can't he see Sergius?
He's not looking for Sergius. He's coming here.
The fool. I warned him not to. Someone will see him. Well, I don't have to wait for him. I know the Tsar must be there.
Or if you don't know, something may have gone wrong. Wait for Prince Ogareff. A few more moments can't make any difference. He's halfway here.
Running like a madman. Doesn't he know that people are staring?
Boris, something must have happened.
Quickly, go let him in. Get him inside.
Your Excellency, this way.
Well?
My wife is in the cathedral.
The Tsar. What about the Tsar?
Yes, he's there. She came with him.
Then she lied about going to the country?
Yes, to save my feelings. She didn't want to hurt me.
But she did. And so history has been changed.
No, don't touch the key.
Boris, no.
You can't. You can't do it now.
Because of your wife, you precipitate a revolution. Now, because of her, you want to bring it to a halt?
I'll kill the Tsar myself. I'll go back to the cathedral and kill him openly.
Even if you could, it is not enough.
Boris, be merciful.
Are they merciful? Ivan the Terrible, Peter, the strumpet Catherine, for centuries they have strangled the people.
Not all of them.
Not my wife.
You want me to turn back now to save one woman?
I love her.
Can the people eat your love? Will it put clothes on their backs?
Think if it was your wife.
I have no wife.
If it was someone you love.
I told you once, Prince Ogareff, I can't afford the luxury of love.
Boris, if I were in the cathedral, what would you do?
I would press the key.
Oh,
you wouldn't.
There's no one I wouldn't sacrifice to destroy the tyrant who strangles the people. Olga, come back here.
She's going to tell the police.
No, she will only walk about in the snow, wringing her hands for a while, and then she will be coming crawling back here because she's weak, like you. Her will has been destroyed by love. So now...
No! Nothing happened. You push the key, and nothing happened.
Boris.
What have you done? What have you done?
I broke the wire. You will never find it in the snow.
You broke the...
No, put down the gun. She was right.
I did it for your sake, Boris. To save you from committing murder. To save your soul. You are sick, Boris. You're without love. With all my heart, I love and pity you.
Pity? Nietzsche once said, the fundamental fault of the female character is that it has no sense of justice. It was true of Olga Karolska when she put what she called love above everything else. It was a glorious plan. It failed. because of her. And now, they are coming for me.
Boris Scriabin?
Yes. I'm ready.
Come with me.
Olga said she did it for me, to save me from murder. Didn't she know that she forced me to murder her? And she said she pitied me. What did she mean? Why should she pity me? No, I'm not ready to die yet. I can't die before I know what she meant.
Halt!
No! Olga! Don't let them kill me. Not yet. Tell them there is so much I don't know. So much I have to learn. Tell them.
Ready!
Olga!
Aim!
Olga!
Fire! Olga!
Again next week, when we bring you another tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
Suspense on Tuned to Yesterday, a William N. Robeson production from January 13th, 1957 on CBS. Robeson had taken over about 10 episodes earlier for the departing Anthony Ellis, who was the longtime director of the show, with William N. Robeson being a famed director in his own right, and he produced some great episodes in his tenure on Suspense, like Three Skeleton Key with Vincent Price, Chicken Feed with Lloyd Bridges, and the very scary story The Yellow Wallpaper featuring Agnes Moorehead. It's an hour of crime on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levenier. And now time for The Whistler, with an episode from January 30th, 1944 on CBS. It's the Robert S. Brody story, All Damage Covered, starring Doris Singleton and Gerald Moore.
The Whistler.
Whistler, and I know many things, for I walk by night. I know many strange tales hidden in the hearts of men and women who have stepped into the shadows. Yes, I know the nameless terrors of which they dare not speak.
And now the Whistler's strange story, All Damage Covered.
As usual, the swank Orchid Room was crowded. And the reason for the popularity of this small nightclub in downtown Los Angeles was obvious. At the moment, the tall, slender girl with the honey-colored hair stood before the microphone on the dance floor, swaying with the rhythm of her song.
Just who can solve its mystery? Why should it make a fool of me?
Maxine had sung those words over and over, night after night. But suddenly she seemed to be singing them for the first time. Suddenly she was the woman the words were written for. The thought of killing him had occurred to her before, but never in the middle of a song had she known this cold-blooded, dispassionate desire to kill the man she'd married.
What is called love?
Later, in her dressing room, Maxine had changed into her street clothes when she heard a knock on the door. And she didn't have to guess who it was. This wasn't just her boss. This was Jim McCoy, a guy as real as his name.
Hiya, Songbird.
Hello, Jim.
Oh, you were great tonight. Real great. Sounded like you meant every word of it, baby.
Maybe I did.
Well, keep it up. I can always add a few more chairs for the customers. Well, I gotta get back to the lounge.
What's your hurry?
Hurry? And we usually say goodnight about this time?
That's what I mean. Do we have to?
Now, look, baby. We've been through all this before.
Observation.
The tone of your voice goes well with the cold of your shoulder.
Maxine, things were different when you were a cute trick on the loose. You may be Miss Maxine to the customers, but to me, you're Mrs. Charlie Kendall.
I know. But after all, what's in a name?
Look, baby, maybe they don't show, but I still have a couple of old scruples lying around.
Don't kid yourself. They show something awful.
Charlie needs you, now more than ever. It's no fun not being able to walk, cooped up day in and day out. You're all he's got.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right, Jim. Forget it.
Yeah, I think we'd better. Well, good night, Songbird.
And so, Maxine, a half hour later, you're driving over the freeway, going home to Charlie, your husband. You can't help but admire Jim for turning you down, can you? Because of the way things stand. Because you're married to Charlie. You drive on through the night thinking about it. And by the time you reach the outskirts of Ellenville, you've decided that there must be a showdown with Charlie. As you start to plan the things you'll say...
Sorry, lady, roadblock.
Oh, but I live in Carpencita. I've got to get home.
There's been a landslide. Won't be able to get through for a couple of hours yet.
Oh, I see.
Train coming through in about 10 minutes from L.A. Or if you'd rather, you can go back to the main road, take a 10-mile detour.
No, thanks. I'll take the train.
You turn your car around, and minutes later, park it on a quiet side street near the depot and hurry to catch the train. Shortly before 4 a.m, you unlock the front door of your house in Carpencita. As you step into the living room, you see Charlie, stretched out on the couch, an empty bottle on the floor, the cane propped up against the end table, cigarette smoke curling up around the hand that dangles over the edge of the couch. It's a familiar sight to you, isn't it, Maxine? Charlie's been an invalid for 2 years now. His leg, injured again when he fell while getting off the suburban train a month ago, still hasn't mended. You hurry to Charlie's side. From his hand, you take the cigarette that's ready to fall to the floor.
Charlie. Come on, sweetheart. Come to the party. Charlie. Charlie, wake up.
Oh, Maxie. Hey, oh, baby.
Yeah, baby's home.
Must have dropped off. What time is it?
Oh, a few minutes to 4.
4? Well, what took you so long, Maxine?
There was a roadblock at Ellenville.
Oh, that's too bad.
I had to leave the car there and take the train.
Sure.
I had to wait 10 minutes for the train. It took 15 minutes to get to Carpencita, 20 minutes to get a cab to take me here, and now...
Okay, honey, I believe you.
Well, why shouldn't you? It's the truth.
Sure it is, baby, sure.
You don't believe a word of it. You never do. And you want to know something? I don't care, Charlie. I don't care what you believe anymore.
Don't you think I know that, Maxie? Honey, don't rub it in, huh? I know you go out on dates when you're finished at the club. I even know about the guy you work for, McCoy.
I was not on a date tonight with Jim or anybody else.
Oh, sure, baby, anything you say. I'll never ask any more questions. Just as long as you come home to me.
Maybe I'm sick of coming home. Maybe I'll never come home again.
Don't say that, Maxie.
Why shouldn't I? I mean it.
I've told you before, you'll never get rid of me. We're married and you can't change that.
Don't tempt me, Charlie.
You struggle to control the rage that's sweeping over you. Turn away from Charlie and hurry into the bedroom. You stand there in the darkness by the open window while the frost of night bites the anger in your cheeks. The train, Maxine. Yes. Why couldn't it have been late tonight? 10 minutes late. 10 minutes. The cigarette would have slipped out of Charlie's hand. The straw rug would have caught on fire. It would have solved all your problems. Suddenly, an idea flickers through your mind. It could happen again. Charlie could fall asleep with a cigarette in his hand. There'd be a fire. But you'd be somewhere else when that happened, Maxine. An alibi. All you need is an alibi. And in an instant, it becomes crystal clear to you how you can get one.
Maxie. Maxie.
Huh? Oh, what is it, Charlie?
Oh. All by yourself in the dark, baby? What's on your mind?
The train, Charlie. I was just thinking about the train.
You've reached a decision, haven't you, Maxine? You're going to rid yourself of your husband, Charlie, once and for all. And you know exactly how you're going to do it. You can see it all now, the way it's going to happen. The official version of the accident. Charlie asleep on the couch. The empty bottle of liquor on the floor. A lighted cigarette dropping from his hand to the straw rug, and then the fire. And you weren't around to prevent it. It's late afternoon of the following day when you awaken. And as you recall your plan, your heart throbs with a sick, dizzy excitement. After a reassuring cup of coffee, you call the train depot. Check the schedule of the evening train to Los Angeles. Then you take your time dressing. Fight to remain calm. Shortly before 5:30.
Maxie. Hey, Maxie, your cab's here.
Coming.
Well, what's in the suitcase, honey?
Oh, it's just a dress I'll need at the club. Bye now.
Bye. Maxie.
Yes?
Try to make it home early tonight, will you? Gets kind of lonesome around here.
Don't worry, Charlie. I'll be back before you know it.
A quarter of an hour later, you reach the depot. Buy your ticket and start for the train. You're about to put your plan into operation, aren't you, Maxine? And you smile to yourself as you think of the first move. Charlie's accident on this very line put the idea into your head. As you reach the train, you start up the steps. One step and then another. And as you near the platform, you deliberately place your foot between the two steps and throw yourself forward.
Oh!
Miss! Miss, are you hurt?
I don't know.
Here, wait. Here, let me help you. There. You'd better sit down. The train's moving.
Thank you. I'll be all right. It's terribly clumsy on me.
Well, accidents do happen.
They seem to run in the family. A month ago, my husband had a similar fall. Oh!
Your ankle?
Yes. It'll be all right now, I'm sure.
Well, is there anything I can do, miss?
No, thank you.
Well, I'm sorry. I'll have to have your name, miss, my report, you know. It's just routine.
Oh, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Charles Kendall.
Mrs. Charles Kendall. Address, please.
752 Mapleton Drive.
You smile, lean forward, continue to rub your ankle as you watch the conductor fill in the report. Everything's there, isn't it, Maxine? Your name, the date, time of accident. Yes, everything working according to plan. You've established your presence on the train to Los Angeles. As soon as the conductor is out of sight, you pick up your suitcase, hurry into the ladies' room. A few minutes later, you emerge wearing a dull, faded coat, a drab hat pulled down over your eyes. All traces of your original makeup have been removed. And in your new makeup, you've suddenly become a different woman. A plain, older-looking, unattractive woman.
Bellinville! Next stop, Bellinville!
As the train stops, you get off without delay and hurry away from the depot. You find your car where you'd parked it the night before, on the quiet side street, and minutes later you're racing a good 70 miles an hour along the road back to Carpencita. Luckily, your train is a slow train, because you must make up a good 35 minutes before it arrives in Los Angeles. It's dark now, and no one sees you as you arrive in Carpencita. You quietly park in an alley and then walk quickly to the rear entrance at your home and slip inside. And then you're standing in the living room, looking down on Charlie, sprawled out on the couch. The sleeping powder you slipped into his drink before you left has taken effect, hasn't it, Maxie?
Charlie?
He doesn't stir. Quickly, you light a cigarette. Drop it on the straw rug. In a few seconds, it begins to smolder. In strange fascination, you watch the flames begin to creep along the floor. And then you turn and run from the house. It's over, isn't it, Maxine? The worst part of all. As you hurry back to the car, you know there's only one more thing that you have to do. You must overtake the train at one of the many stops it makes and somehow get back on board unnoticed. To be in the clear, perfectly safe, that conductor must see you get off at Union Station. Those are tense moments, aren't they, Maxine? Moments that seem like a lifetime. You take this short, straight highway into Los Angeles, hitting better than 70 miles an hour most of the way. Finally, you catch your train at one of its last stops and get back on just in time. Disappear quickly into the lounge room, where you can change back into your original outfit.
Mrs. Kendall, ankle better, Mrs. Kendall?
Yes, thank you, conductor.
Oh, that's fine. Union Station!
Your plan has worked perfectly, hasn't it, Maxine? You keep telling yourself that over and over again. And then, as the train stops and you walk back to step off, you freeze suddenly and stare in terror at a man standing on the crowded station platform.
Oh, no.
You recognize him, don't you, Maxine? This man in the pinstriped suit. Instantly, your mind goes back to that night a few weeks ago when you came home late just as this same man was leaving and you heard him say to Charlie...
Now, don't worry, Kendall. I'll take care of everything.
It's all clear to you now, isn't it, Maxine? Now you know why this man in the pinstriped suit was talking to Charlie a couple of weeks ago. Charlie was hiring him to follow you. Perhaps he was following you tonight. You step back into the train... Hurry through the cars and get off further down the platform. It isn't until you climb into a taxi and try to settle back that you realize you're trembling all over, shaking uncontrollably. Somehow you manage to compose yourself, regain your confidence by the time you reach the club and go inside to greet Jim at the bar.
Hiya, Songbird.
Hello, Jim.
Say, your feathers look a little ruffled. You're limping.
Oh, I fell and scraped my knee while I was getting on the train tonight.
Train? How come you took the train?
I was too tired to drive all the way home last night, so I left the car in town.
Well, you better take it easy. Sure you want to go tonight?
Oh, don't worry. I'll make it.
Okay. How's Charlie?
Charlie?
Don't tell me you've forgotten our little conversation last night.
Oh, no, Jim. I haven't forgotten. As a matter of fact, I'm very grateful to you. You made me see what my duty was.
Yeah. Glad to hear it, baby.
That night, you deliver the songs mechanically, don't you, Maxine? Because your mind is on something else. It's been 4 hours since the fire started, and you still haven't had any word. But as you approach your dressing room...
Maxine!
Oh, I didn't see you, Jim.
There's a call for you, baby. You can take it in my office.
Call?
Mm-hmm.
Who is it?
Long distance, yeah. Cop and Seater. Probably Charlie.
Your mind is blank for the next few moments until you find yourself alone in Jim's office, your fingers tightly gripping the telephone receiver as you slowly raise it to your lips.
Hello?
Mrs. Kendall?
Yes, this is Mrs. Kendall.
This is Captain Craig, Cop and Seater Fire Department.
Oh?
I'm sorry, Mrs. Kendall. I have some bad news about your husband.
It won't take long, Maxine. Coroner just wants to ask some questions.
Your husband was an invalid, was he not?
That's right.
Smoked quite a bit, is that correct?
Yes, he smoked quite a bit.
And he was a heavy drinker as well.
Well, drinking helped relieve his pain.
Oh, don't misunderstand me, Mrs. Kendall. I'm not trying to establish that your husband was a chronic alcoholic, just that he did drink at times to a point of...
Yes, he did.
Oh, then I think the conclusion we drew from the evidence is correct. Your husband fell asleep with a lighted cigarette while in a state of intoxication. The cigarette fell, and that was it.
I was afraid that would happen someday. I warned him so many times.
Easy, Maxine.
Mrs. Kendall, if you'll please sign this.
What? Yes.
Honey, you're trembling. Here, I'll hold it.
I...
What is it, Mrs. Kendall?
Oh, nothing. I'm just upset, that's all.
Oh,
I'm sorry, Mrs. Kendall. Thank you for your cooperation.
And finally, it's over, Maxine. Really over. Without even the necessity for the alibi which you went to so much trouble establishing. The man from the coroner's office is gone, and you're alone with Jim, with no more barriers between you. It's all you can do to keep from blurting out how good you feel inside, how little you need the rest that Jim is trying to insist upon.
I still think you should take it easy, honey. Stay in bed for a while.
Oh, no, Jim. I'm not going to let myself brood about this. I want to work. It'll help, I know.
Okay, Songbird, you win.
Oh, thanks, Jim. I appreciate everything you've done, and I hope I sound sentimental.
You do. I can take it.
I'll see you later.
What is this thing called love? This funny thing called love? Just who?
That night, your song is different. The nervousness is gone, isn't it, Maxine? Suddenly, you're gripped with terror, and the song dies in your throat.
A fool of...
Through the amber haze, sitting motionless at the bar, you see the man in the pinstripe suit. In that instant, you're certain he was hired by your husband to follow you. You don't know how long he's been following you, but in that moment of desperation, you suddenly turn, flee from your surprised audience toward the dressing rooms.
Who is it?
It's me. Now, look, Maxine, what's this all about?
What did that man say to you, Jim?
Oh, it's got you worried, hasn't it?
No, I'm not worried. It's just a nervous reaction.
Now, listen to me,
all.
Baby. This isn't a relapse. This is something else. How about you kicking in with a few more details?
I'm unstrung.
Answer me one question.
What question?
What do you know about that fire?
Nothing, Jim. How could I know?
Answer me.
There's nothing to answer, Jim. What's wrong? Why do you keep looking at me that way?
Look, Maxine, I thought something was phony last night when you got that call from the fire department. When I told you I thought it was Charlie, you almost keeled over. And I think I know why, baby. You already knew about that fire.
No, Jim,
and if
no.
you knew about it, you started it.
I swear I didn't. Oh, Jim, please don't tell that to him. He knows too much already, Jim. And
I thought so. And to think I was in love with you.
Oh, please, Jim. Please, you're all I've got.
Take your hands off me.
Jim!
Go on and cry to that guy out front. He wants to see you.
Oh, don't go, Jim. Don't leave me alone. Not now. You gotta help me. You gotta help me figure this out. Jim, you mustn't leave me. Not now. Jim!
Frantically, you slip into your coat, hurry out the side door after him. But Jim's nowhere in sight, and you leap into a waiting cab.
Yeah, where to, lady?
Would you mind cruising around a bit? I'm looking for someone. A man.
Sure, lady. See me, lady?
No, I don't. But let's not stop.
Okay. You sure the guy you're looking for ain't looking for you?
What?
There's a black car been following us ever since we started.
No, that's not the man I want. Driver, turn the corner. Do anything but lose that car.
As you speed along the street, it suddenly occurs to you exactly what's happening. Yes, you ran out to find Jim. And now you're trying to escape the man in the pinstripe suit. Fear sweeps over you and crowds Jim from your mind. And you know you've got to get away from this man. The black car is only a block behind you as your cab races into the dark, deserted manufacturing district. Screeches around one corner, then another, and another. Turning, twisting, and then suddenly...
Driver!
Yeah?
That station up ahead. Is that the electric train?
Yeah!
Here, this will take care of the fare. Let me off. Quickly!
The black car is nowhere in sight as you leave the cab and hurry to the dimly lit, deserted station. You're praying wildly for a train when suddenly you're relieved to see the lights approaching in the distance. And then as you step out on the platform...
Hey there!
You see the man in the pinstripe suit hurrying toward you. Quickly, you run down the platform, dart behind a stack of packing cases.
Mrs. Kendall, wait a minute!
You hear his footsteps approaching along the platform. Your hands move up in front of you. You wait. And then as he steps into view, you lunge.
I'll kill you, too.
Hey.
I'll kill you.
group of passengers had gathered on the station platform. Standing around in shocked silence, they'd waited until the ambulance arrived and the police.
Okay. Now, let's keep back a little here. Okay, here, get back.
I saw the whole thing, officer. I was sitting up front by the window. I could see just as plain as...
All right, lady, all right. You'll get your turn. I want to know what the motorman has to say first.
But I tell you...
If you don't mind.
Well,
go ahead, you.
Well, officer, when we got close to the station platform, I see this woman, and she tries to push this fella onto the tracks. Huh? And then the fella steps out of her way, and she goes over herself. I couldn't stop in time to keep from hitting her.
Oh, yeah. I see. Well, now, here. Where's the fella she was trying to push over? Where?
Right here, sir.
Oh, will you come up here? What's your name?
Henry Cooper.
Did you know that woman?
No, I never got a chance to meet her. I've just been trying to. Her name's Mrs. Kendall.
Well, how come she tried to push you in front of a train?
I don't know. You see, I work for the railroad, claims investigator.
Yeah?
Well, a month ago, her husband was in an accident.
Uh-huh.
Funny thing, a couple of days ago, she was in a similar accident. I only wanted her to sign a voucher so I could give her a check to cover all damages.
The Whistler on Tuned to Yesterday from January 30th, 1944 on CBS. And that wraps this hour of crime on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. Thanks for tuning in.